You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 27, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Digby will join us to recap the first presidential debate of 2016, plus added sniffles.
My new Trump impression.
Also on the program today, will that be Trump's last debate? Trump's new head of the EPA transition team, a climate denier. Disorderly conduct arrests plummet as phone video usage goes up. This is actually breaking from a Twitter account. David Wildstein, I think he's testifying right now in the Bridgegate trial. Testifies that he and Bill Baroni, Wildstein, of course, was the special czar of who knows what in the Christie administration, liaison between the transit authority and the governor's office or something, some made up.
Almost like being the statistician, I can't pronounce that, on a high school baseball team.
Right. Testifies that he and Bill Baroni, who was at the Port Authority, bragged to Governor Christie about the GW bridge lane closures as they were going on.
Hashtag deputize Bruce Springsteen now.
So, I mean, we had heard before the prosecutors claim this in their opening remarks, and now we have testimony from one of the people involved in the actual scandal. So all that and more on today's program. We've got a full roundup. We have released the debate and our pre-debate and post-debate coverage of the debate to our members as of last night. And, you know, it's not as our talking during it is not as dense, certainly, as it was during the Republican debate coverage, because, frankly, we wanted to hear it. And with two people debating, there's a lot less time for us to speak in between. And, of course, it was actually, I think, it was a pretty good debate. I mean, considering that Donald Trump was one of the people involved in it, I think honestly that puts a ceiling on things. we're taking the high road on the debate analysis there, but and I think Lester Holt actually did a good job. I mean, just to set the table, because I don't want to take away from my conversation with Digby about this, but it has been my contention, and continues to be so, that the quality of these debates from the perspective of someone who does not want Donald Trump to be elected will be determined by the moderator's questions. We did not get a half dozen questions about emails. We did not get questions about what's your favorite color, or, you know, why don't people like the way that you dress, or, You know, there was a couple of those questions where Trump was asked, you said that she doesn't look presidential or that type of thing. But for the most part, it was primarily policy. And that basically sets the playing field. I know there are Republicans out there who are upset that Lester Holt pointed out that the stop and frisk was found unconstitutional. I know that Rudy Giuliani has had a tough time accepting that, but that's why the policy was ended in New York City. Things like, hey, wait a second. No, you said publicly that you support the war. People didn't like Lester Holt stepping in and saying that. But, you know, and some people say they didn't like the fact that Lester Holt didn't somehow prevent Trump from talking significantly more than the time that he was allotted. And my feeling is that, you know, Lester Holt doesn't have a cattle prod. He can't make Donald Trump play by the rules. He can only ask that he does. He can be somewhat forceful, but he can't, you know, you don't want to spend the whole debate going,
I got something else to say, Barry.
You can't do that. But what it does project over the course of a debate is that one of the debaters is an a-hole. And not just an a-hole, but one who isn't really making any points with it. He's just being blustery. And I think ultimately that's something that voters should know. So, you know, I don't know if we're going to get the same level of debate moderating in the future, but I got to say, I thought he did a good job. So we're going to take a... are you trying to IM me about something?
You got
to
do...
Yeah. I'm having trouble connecting to the internet for some reason on that thing. Hey, do you love books, but you find you never have time to read them? Well, Audible.com has the perfect solution. You know, the other day I went, there was one book that I have bought that I started to read, and I do this all the time. I read the book, then I switch to the audio. This is not the way that Matt does it. Matt does both simultaneously. Audible.com has the perfect solution. Get audiobooks and listen to those books you've been meaning to read while on the go. You can do it at the gym, during your commute. Supposedly when you're spending time with the kids, you just got to nod and maybe just wear a hat so they can't see that you have headphones on. Audible.com has audiobooks from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine, and newspaper publishers, business information providers. The app is free. It works on iPhones, iPad, Android, and Windows Phone. You can also download and listen on your Kindle Fire and over 500 MP3 players. And unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. So you can access your books anytime, anywhere, right from your smartphone. Audible.com has the great listen guarantee. If you decide you don't like the book you chose, no worries. Exchange any book you aren't happy with for another title, anytime, no questions asked. Matt, why don't you give the folks, what is the most recent Audible audio book you've listened to?
I recently re-listened to As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner. And the thing, what's really good about it, it's a complex book, but with multiple characters, but there are five.
There are multiple characters
in
it?
Well, here's the thing though, Sam, is there are five different narrators for it.
Whoa.
And one of whom is.
So what do? They change the voice?
Yeah. I think there's one guy who's kind of an all-purposer doing multiple voices, but Robertson Dean he narrates the Daryl parts, or Darryl, sorry. And it's great. Yeah, I think he has one of the best voices and narrators. And
do you have like a list of favorite narrators? Like, will you choose an audiobook based on the actual narrator?
Yeah, there are certain narrators. Well,
how can you tell the difference when you listen to it at such a high speed?
Well, some voices are made to be sped up.
Are you serious? You can tell the difference between them? You listened to it like 3 times.
Yeah, 2.5 to 3 times.
And you can tell the difference between the voices?
Oh, totally. You could, too. Oh, yeah. Anyone could.
Right, of course.
Emphasis on anyone.
They're all, like, you can tell the difference between, like, the 3 different, like, chipmunks in that movie, too, right?
If you slow their voices down, they just sound like regular ladies.
They're ladies?
Ladies?
They're women who do the chipmunk's voice.
Is that right?
I've slowed them down before, yep.
You're a weird person. You're very weird.
I'm glad Matt has benign interests.
Just for our listeners, Audible.com is offering a free 30-day trial membership. So you can listen to your favorite audiobooks on any speed for 30 days. Go to audible.com/majority today to start your free trial. Again, show your support for the show and get a 30-day free trial at audible.com/majority. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be talking to Digby. But first, let me leave you with this clip, number one. Can you do it? Sorry. I did a head fake.
Mexico.
All right, we'll be right back after this.
We don't know why he goes so far and keep on marching along, beating his drum. Clubs and sticks and bats and balls for nuclear dicks with their dialect drawls that come from a parking lot town where nothing lives in the sun. Don't make me a target. Don't make me a target. When he reached back in his mind, feels like he's breaking the law. There's something back there he got.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome the proprietor of the Uber blog, Hullabaloo, and a columnist for Salon.com, Heather Digby Parton. Welcome, Digby.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, the debate. You want to start with your broad feelings on the debate?
Sure. To me, and I had, it's funny, because the day of the debate, I had written a column for Salon talking about how, yeah, I'd gone back and sort of reviewed the debates in the primaries and noticed that at the end of the debate process, and, you know, Trump stopped doing debates. You remember towards the end, he sort of, I think he bailed on the last one, said he wouldn't do it. And he when he was in with just 3 others, I think it was Rubio, Kasich, and Cruz, He was less of a free-for-all. He didn't have the ability to kind of deflect all the questions, make jokes, you know, do his little dominance dance and all that. And he actually had to try to answer questions. And it became obvious that when it came to substance, the guy is completely and utterly unprepared. And it would seem has no underlying knowledge that he might be able to even bluff his way through. So I sort of said, unless he's done a lot of studying. This debate is likely to show that again, that he is just basically, unfit, not just temperamentally, but intellectually as well. He just doesn't have that. So I wasn't entirely surprised to see what happened last night, which was, I believe, he demonstrated in spades that he is just, he is manifestly unprepared to be president, and it showed. It was a disastrous debate for him, I believe, and I think that it seems to me that with the way these things normally work, you get the public's impression, which, to the extent they're measured seemed to show that most people agree with me that he was a disaster and that she was clearly the winner. And then that can change if the spin from the punditocracy is the opposite. We've seen that happen before, as it did back in 2000 when Al Gore, they sort of switched the narrative on him. And people came over time to agree with the pundits that he had actually lost. That's not going to happen this time because the press and, you know, the pundits actually also declared it a disaster. So that is this debate will stick, I think, as a disastrous performance. And my personal opinion is that I think it will have some slight effect. You know, at this point, people are dug into their positions mostly, so I don't know how much anything can change it. But there is some wiggle room, obviously, somewhere in there with undecideds or people going third party, and I think the debate may have some positive effect for, you know, the future of the of the world. in that, I think that a few people may, you know, recognize for the first time just what a disaster Donald Trump actually is.
Yeah, and I think I would add that in terms of impact. I mean, you have, you know, it's hard to know whether or not what they're going to have on polls. And we should say that in terms of like the polling and the sort of, I guess, pieces of evidence as to how the public responded to this. I mean, you can't really know, right, until you see see it in the polls, if there's a change in the polls. But in terms of the debate itself, we have the PPP polling, which showed that she won. This is according to the PPP's post debate survey. 63% said that she won the debate under with young voters, to 24% for Trump. I mean, that's a big split. Across all ages, it was 51-40, but with people who are, I think, under 30. It was 63-24%. 47% in that age group said the debate made them more likely to vote for her, which I think is could be the biggest, the most significant part, right? I mean, because and that, I mean, it's interesting. Well, let's draw some conclusions after. I should just say there was a couple. There was the Frank Luntz focus group, which people anticipate will always favor the right-wing candidate, although, you know, his affiliation with Fox post-Ailes may temper that. I mean, I think it the Luntz thing I always think is sort of rigged anyways, but it's less important as to whether or not it's rigged, and it's more important just because people cite it, you know, as it, like you say, there are sort of onions to this. And,
exactly.
You know, the Luntz thing, you know, convinces John Podhoretz or whatever to write, Trump let us all down. And in fact, here is Frank Luntz. Let's play a clip of Frank Luntz on Charlie Rose last night, talking about how people responded to the debate. And again, I personally refer to Frank Luntz as the ethically and follically challenged Frank Luntz. So it's less relevant to me whether or not his results are genuine. More relevant to me that this enters into the bloodstream and gives us an indication of what the narrative is going to be. I mean, you know, let's face it, folks, they have spin rooms at these debates that are more active than the debates themselves in many respects. So let's listen to this.
Not. Okay, Frank Luntz, you've been out there and you've got a focus group that you could be talking to or have already talked to in part. What did you think?
So we asked them when they were done, these are truly undecided voters between the candidates, and 16 of them felt that Hillary Clinton had won the debate, had brought them closer to her candidacy. Only five of them picked Donald Trump, and the remaining 6% were tied. There were four key components here. Number one is that Donald Trump, when he was attacking the system, he was doing well. When he was defending himself, that was a disaster. Number two, Hillary Clinton was so well prepared for this. And I agree with what Maureen said. And I actually had written down the word baiting him within 3 minutes of the debate opening. And she did it again and again and again. And Trump responded horribly. Number three, you don't speak over the moderator ever. And viewers, our undecideds, felt that he was, frankly, rude to Lester Holt. And number four is that Trump described the problems effectively, but he didn't have the solutions. She was not quite as effective in discussing the problems, but they felt that she had better answers. In the end, solutions beat problems.
All right, I'll be right back, Frank.
So there it is, Frank Luntz. And prior to that, Maureen Dowd was on, and she even had complimentary things to say. And so that creates the spin, and I think there was a focus group on CNN that came out with Clinton ahead. So you had all that. I mean, that's the sort of like objective standards, and then you see the spin. I think one of the things, too, that's going to come out of it is that this is going to change the trajectory of Trump's campaign in some way, because just like, you know, just like Clinton could bait him and get a reaction in real time during the debate, the fallout from the debate has the same impact.
I think so, too. I mean, this, he does not take, to put it mildly, Trump does not take well to criticism. And he tends to double down on whatever he's done. He's not someone to make willingly make course corrections. And as his co-writer Tony Schwartz, who co-wrote The Art of the Deal with him, and who's been a harsh critic, and who evidently spent a lot of time with him and kind of got to know him very well, or came to understand him anyway, how he is. He actually says that Trump is incapable of learning. Very much. It's just not, he's unable to focus. He doesn't have the power of any kind of intense concentration. And of course, he has all these psychological issues, this narcissism. I mean, look at what he said in the debate last night. I mean, he said basically that Clinton had only come up with solutions, economic solutions, once he entered the race, that she'd never thought about it before. And he said that NATO had developed a terrorism policy in response to his criticisms in a debate. The world revolves around him. So, he finds it very difficult, I think, to be able to adjust to this. However, they obviously will try. And I think it's pretty clear from the spin room last night how he's going to do that. He's going to take the gloves off. He came out into the spin room, which was weird in itself to see the general election candidate in the spin room, but he did it. Obviously, feeling the need to say more because the debate didn't go that well, so he had to try and shore up his performance. And he pretty much said that he, was going to, that he didn't feel she'd been nice, nice, and therefore he was going to take the gloves off the next time. And even Kellyanne Conway, she sort of, said that as well. Well, he has a right to defend himself, and I think he'll be tougher on her next time.
Oh, yeah, he said specifically he was going to talk about Bill's indiscretions.
Yeah. That's fine. I mean, I feel like, people... I suspect that she is prepared for that and will, deal with that appropriately. And I think that, the country, I don't really think the country cares about Bill's indiscretions at this point. So
I got to think
that's probably.
I got to think from her campaign's perspective, they would welcome it. I think that from the perspective of a campaign that wants to make him expose himself. Mm-hmm. I think that in their minds, they're like, bring it on. I got to imagine he's been talking about this for 6 months, right? I mean, he was raising the specter of this. And as uncomfortable as it might be for her, it's not like she hasn't been subjected to this. I got to imagine they are like, bring it on. This is the one that, I mean, this is what will sink him. I think in a way, but let's go over some of the moments of the debate because, broadly speaking, what did you think about Lester Holt? Because, I think we spoke after the first debate, and poor Matt Lauer, man. And by poor Matt Lauer, I don't really mean poor Matt Lauer in any sense of the term poor. I'm just saying, if Matt Lauer was hoping that somebody would do even worse so that people wouldn't talk about Matt Lauer, he's going to have to wait for the next one.
I don't know that that's possible, to be honest, but of course, I suppose it always is, but I thought he did fine personally. I felt like, with just the two on the stage, I think they were both, I think Clinton was handling herself fine. I didn't feel like she needed any kind of interference from Lauer, from Holt, even though Trump interrupted her 51 times. But she seemed to handle that fine, and I think that that's probably good for her. That's a, and especially if, for women watching. We've all dealt with men interrupting us in these in situations like this, in meetings, social occasions, everywhere. This is a very common phenomenon. Women watching another woman handle it is kind of a actually a, you know, you, I think that a lot of women go, okay, she's good at this. She knows what she'll be able to deal with this if, you know, Vladimir Putin is interrupting her in a meeting. She can deal with it. So, you know, that may have actually been a reassuring thing. And I thought that Holt did fine. I mean, I don't know. He seemed to be kind of unobtrusive, but he did press Trump on the birther issue, and he pressed him on what he meant, you know, that this is a, you know, this is racial healing. He also called him on the Iraq war lie, which I think is very important to continuously do. And you know, Trump responded as we would have expected by, you know, blatantly lying about it. So I thought he did fine. I mean, what did you think? Did you think
I have to say, like, it's hard for me to imagine a moderator doing a significantly better job. I mean, he started off by saying, look, I'm not going to get to all the questions and all the topics that I should. He threw it to the next two debates. And I think, you know, I would have I'm not sure what questions I would have necessarily asked on the first of three debates, setting that parameters. He didn't get into, I mean, he did a couple of the email and the, you know, a couple of the you said that she was, you know, not suited to be president or didn't look the part. But for the most part, he kept it on the issues. And I think that terrain was, I mean, from the perspective of somebody who does not want Donald Trump to be president, that was the best thing a moderator could do, it seems to me. Set the terrain, say, we're going to play this on this field that deals with issues as opposed to personalities, which basically takes away from Trump his ability to attack in the way that he likes to. And I think, you know, Trump sort of ran over Holt a couple of times. But I think to a certain extent, you know, what's Holt going to do? And I don't think that's hard for your average American to say, like, well, this guy's rude. And, you know, according to Frank Luntz, that was, in fact, the response that that people had to it. So I thought he did about as good of a job as you could expect from a moderator to do. I mean, maybe, you know, I suspect Martha Raddatz is going to be a little bit more, probing with both candidates. But that's a matter of style to a large extent. I think, you know, the important thing was just, like, keep it on the issues. And so let's get to some of those issues. Or this one, I guess, is a little bit less about the issue, but more about sort of like judgment in the past and claims. And that is that Trump insists that he was not for the war in Iraq, even though there is audio of him on the Howard Stern program saying that he was for the Iraq invasion before it took place. And, you know, Trump, he sees some wiggle room there. Let's listen to this exchange.
Mr. Trump, a lot of these are judgment questions. You had supported the war in Iraq before the invasion. What makes your judgment?
I did not support the war in Iraq.
2002.
That is a mainstream media nonsense put out by her because she, frankly, I think the best person in her campaign is mainstream media.
My question is, since you
would you like to hear
it, why is your
judgment? I was against the war. Wait a minute. I was against the war in Iraq, just so you put it out.
The record shows otherwise.
The record does not show that.
Why was you, is your judgment
any... The record shows that I'm right. When I did an interview with Howard Stern, very lightly, first time anyone's asked me that, I said, very lightly, I don't know, maybe, who knows, essentially. I then did an interview with Neil Cavuto. We talked about the economy is more important. I then spoke to Sean Hannity, which everybody refuses to call Sean Hannity. I had numerous conversations with Sean Hannity at Fox, and Sean Hannity said, and he called me the other day, and I spoke to him about it. He said, you were totally against the war, because he was for the war.
Why is and your judgment better than
And that was before the war started. Sean Hannity said very strongly to me and other people, he's willing to say, but nobody wants to call him, I was against the war. He said, you used to have fights with me because Sean was in favor of the war. And I understand that site also, not very much, because we should have never been there. But nobody called Sean Hannity. And then they did an article in a major magazine shortly after the war started, I think in 04, but they did an article which had me totally against the war in Iraq. And one of your compatriots said, you know, whether it was before or right after, Trump was definitely, because if you read this article, there's no doubt. But if somebody, and I'll ask the press, if somebody would call up Sean Hannity, this was before the war started, he and I used to have arguments about the war. I said it's a terrible a stupid thing. It's going to destabilize the Middle East, and that's exactly what it's done. It's been a disaster.
My reference was to what you had said in 2002. And my
Now, Digby, you and I are old enough to know the relevance of 2002 as opposed to 2004. Do you want to enlighten some of the younger people in our audience here? Because we may have some nine-year-olds.
Yeah, I mean, this is... look, this was in 2002. It's not as if nobody in the world or in the country was saying that they not to go into Iraq. We had massive protests all over the world. We had massive protests in New York. I went to them here in Los Angeles. I participated in a thing on the beach where we all did the, you know, the peace dove. There were thousands of us there, and we did this. We got in a formation on the beach, and they took a big picture of it and stuff. I mean, this was a big deal. It was happening all over the world. In fact, if people recall, going into the war, the UN failed to approve the war. And that was because the people of places like France and Germany and others would not sign on to the thing because it was absolutely obvious that it was a stupid thing to do. Now
wait a second, Digby. Are you saying that Trump? You did not see Trump on that beach with you?
I didn't. He wasn't there. He wasn't at the beach. I didn't see him at the protest.
Yeah, maybe
you know, most of us weren't invited on Howard Stern to talk about this at the time. Those of us who were adamantly opposed to the war, we didn't get a chance to go. And you know, we couldn't go on Larry King. We couldn't call up our pals at, you know, Sean Hannity, for instance, who, you know, I don't know why Donald Trump didn't go on his show and say all of this, and he just said it in a, you know, while they were sitting at their coffee klatch in the morning or whatever the hell it was. So, you know, it's not as if Donald Trump couldn't have said something or that there weren't millions of people all over the planet saying something. He just, you know, he just didn't have anything to, I guess he just didn't feel comfortable with it or something. But
well, I get it. What he's saying is he was lightly for it in public, but strongly against it privately.
Right. Well, there's a bold leader for you. You know what I mean?
Well, I got to also be honest. Sean Hannity told me contemporaneously that Trump was for the war. No one's called me about that. No one has called me about that.
I can't believe that, Sam. I mean, wouldn't this just put the whole thing to rest?
I can put the whole thing to rest. Sean Hannity told me. Call me. Call me. Somebody call me. Well, the best part, though, is that apparently, in terms of the Cavuto thing, this is hilarious. Somebody tweeted this to me. So Trump says that, well, I said something, I was lightly for it sort of in 2002, but I did a Cavuto interview where I was definitely against it, an interview a year after the war started, at least, where I was against it. And then I told Sean Hannity private, but here's the Cavuto. I listened to this audio. She may not be able to hear it, actually. Yeah, hold on one second. But this is, Matt, send me an IM. Bear with me here.
Sure.
It's right here. Sorry. Just play it right off that Twitter. Listen to this. And Cavuto, and we should say about this, Cavuto actually does an edit. He's presenting it in real time after the debate last night of when the interview took place, and he does an edit. So let's just give Neil Cavuto the benefit of the doubt that he didn't edit in such a way to make Trump look even more against the war at this point.
Right, because he wouldn't do that.
Right, no. Never.
All right, since my name did come up and has a number of times on this, did he or didn't he want us to go to war in Iraq? It depends on the time period you're talking about, but I think it is very unfair for those in the mainstream media to say that he never had any reservations before we went into that war. In fact, he did in a January 28, 2003 interview with me. Now, there were many interviews during that time with me and others, but this one, before we got into the war, that might tell you a little bit about where Donald Trump was on this issue. Again, January 28, 2003, with me, Donald Trump. Listen. If you had to sort of break down for the president, if you were advising him how much time you commit to Iraq versus how much time you commit to the economy, what would you say?
Well, I'm starting to think that people are much more focused now on the economy. They're getting a little bit tired of, hearing we're going in, we're not going in. Whatever happened to the days of Douglas MacArthur? I mean, he'd go and attack. He wouldn't talk. I mean, we have to, it's sort of like either do it or don't do it.
You're saying the leash on this is getting kind of short here, that the president has got to do something presumably sooner rather than later, and stringing this along could ultimately hurt us.
Well, he's either got to do something or not do something.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Because perhaps he shouldn't be doing it yet. And perhaps we should be waiting for the United Nations. He's under a lot of pressure. I think he's doing a very good job, but of course, if you look at the polls, a lot of people are getting a little tired. I think the Iraqi situation is a problem, and I think the economy is a much bigger problem.
So there it is, Digby, him coming out against the war by saying, "What, our generals would just go in."
Well, and doesn't that just sound like Donald Trump? I mean, there's no doubt. I don't think he edited it. I mean, if he did, I can't imagine what he said that would have been more, more of an indictment of his view. And think about this for a second. I was just thinking as I'm listening to that. This is Fox News trying to defend Donald Trump by saying that he was against the war in Iraq.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't get any more surreal than that. I mean, that's just bizarre. Clearly, and this is him, and he says this all the time, you shouldn't telegraph what you're going to do. You just do it, right? That's what he was counseling the president to do. Don't, why all the back and forth? Why all the Douglas MacArthur, his favorite general, who, by the way, was fired for insubordination by the president. But, I guess Trump doesn't know about that.
Saying, I shall return, perhaps. Perhaps.
His obsession with MacArthur and Patton, does anybody under the age of, 60 know who those people are?
No.
I don't think so. But in any case, it's obvious what he was saying. Now, it is true that Trump is often very sensitive to public opinion. And he was in New York, and he may very well have been sensing some of that, I don't know, maybe he noticed that millions of people were marching through the streets in New York against the war, and perhaps on some level of his lizard brain, he was sensing that maybe the war wasn't all that popular, and being forcefully for it may be a mistake, so maybe he didn't want to talk about it at all, but the of course he was for it. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this is Donald Trump. And, and the point really at this point isn't even whether or not he was. It's the fact that in the face of all this evidence, Donald Trump can't admit that he was. He can't admit that he's lied about it. I mean, he can't admit the birther thing. I mean, this is something that the guy is absolutely constitutionally incapable of doing, which is in any way admitting fault or even very... some politicians are kind of smooth about that. They'll figure out a way to sort of, finesse something like that, and they'll come up with an answer. The best politicians will figure out a way to save face in a situation like that. He just can't do it. His idea is just to say, absolutely, you can believe me or you can believe your lying eyes. And, apparently a lot of people believe their lying eyes, millions of them. So that's kind of disturbing in itself. But
what was interesting
him.
To me, too, about that was that, the Holt pushed back twice. And finally, Trump conceded, well, there's that one little thing with the Rolling Stone and with Howard Stern, rather. And that I did that lightly. And I don't know. I found that interesting. I want to move on to something else in terms of the future debates, because, I mean, assuming that there are going to be some, I think what is important about this debate
whether or not Clinton gets a bump in the polls, and I suspect she might. I think maybe a point or two, but I think it's gonna you know, kick a trend off in that direction. We're going to get a reaction from the Trump himself and from the Trump campaign, and it's going to change the tenor of the next debate. And I suspect we're also going to hear more on is this number three? Is this about him paying taxes? Yeah. Okay. All right. This, I think we're going to hear more about this because Clinton didn't make as much about this as I think she could have going forward. This is a clip number three, and they're talking about Trump's tax returns, which she did a very good job of pointing out, like, why someone might not release their tax returns, despite the fact that that's been the tradition of presidential candidates probably since most people in the room have been alive.
Why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons. First, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Second, maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be. Third, we don't know all of his business dealings, but we have been told through investigative reporting that he owes about $650 million to Wall Street and foreign banks. Or maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes, because the only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes
if he's
smart.
Paid zero, that means zero for troops, zero for vets, zero for schools or health.
That makes me smart. I have a feeling that we may hear that refrain again. That sort of reminds me of the response when they had that exchange about the you didn't pay the people working for you, because that's business. I have a feeling that that's also going to be a problem that comes back.
Oh, I do too. In fact, I mentioned those two responses by him in my piece for Salon this morning. I think that those were very revealing. I mean, for a couple of reasons. I mean, that, and there was one other too, which I felt was really, I think she really hit him in a way that's going to hurt him, which was her bringing up, you know, which we all know about, but I think, you know, doing it in front of an audience of 100 million people is really useful, that he didn't pay his contractors. And his reaction to that was, well, maybe they didn't do a good job.
Oh, right. That's what, okay, right. It's the, let's play that housing collapse. It's just a 30-second clip. Let's play that. That's the one where he said that's business. I think that is, I imagine that's going to be an ad released within the next day. Yes. But here is that clip.
People who rooted for the housing crisis. He said back in 2006, gee, I hope it does collapse, because then I can go in and buy some and make some money. Well, it did collapse.
That's called business, by the way.
9 million people. 9 million people lost their jobs. 5 million people lost their homes. And $13 trillion in family wealth was wiped out.
That's, I mean, tell us your thoughts on that, because it may very well be business. But I think really what comes out of that is most people start going like, hey, maybe we should look into this stuff about business a little bit more.
Well, I think so. And it just, you know, it's one of those, of course, there will be Trump people who goes, well, he was just playing by the rules. You know, that's how he got rich. And, you know, there's a certain strain in American life where people think, you know, if you're rich, that means you're a winner. And if you're a winner, that means, you know, you'll win for me or something, you know. And so I don't know. There are certain people, even among his main voters, which are white, you know, non-college educated, you know, working class type, middle class types, who, you know, were probably the victims of the recession, and many of whom really, really did suffer. But I think that what that says, what she did, and this is something you'll be interested in, Sam, because it's a big theme of yours, I think, through this, and in the hopes that Clinton would take a take a stand on trying to tie him to the Republican Party and tie the Republican Party to him. Last night on MSNBC, Robert Costa, the Washington Post reporter who has very good ties into the right wing, he's an excellent reporter, and he said this. He said she yanked him toward the Republican Party. She said, you're not going to be able to run as an outsider. You can't be a populist. She said, you're just like George W. Bush. You're trickle-down economics like Ronald Reagan. You're supply side, trumped up. This is a candidate whose real appeal is that he's non-ideological, that he's not running as a partisan Mitt Romney, George W. Bush Republican. And she said, I'm not going to let you. So, you know, I think that in some way, somewhere in the back of people's minds, so some of these, you know, and I think most of them are probably non-voters, the kinds who said, you know, I hate them both, not a dime's worth of difference, and I hate those Washington Republicans. You know, they're the people who hate Paul Ryan and, you know, hate everything that's been going on, and they think Donald Trump is different. I think she may have planted a seed of doubt in some of their minds that maybe that's not true. And his reaction, which is, you know, he said, well, that's just, that makes me smart, you know. And she took it a step further and said, well, you know, other people have had to pay for the roads and the schools and all that. You didn't bother to do that. You know, these are things that, you know, maybe people don't want to admit it in their conscious mind. But it's a cutting attack on him at his central argument, which is that he's different than all these other people, that he is, you know, he's a populist, he cares about the working man. Yeah. Now, for me, you know, I've never understood why anybody thought that. But, you know, that combination of him not paying taxes and him, you know, kind of bragging about it and saying that that's just business. I mean, he also said it when, you know, they were talking about people
screwing the contractors.
Yeah. Screwing contractors and saying, well, you know, maybe they didn't do a good job. That's the kind of thing that working people, at least some, you know, I don't know who, that somewhere along the line, it may you know, sort of at least raise a little doubt that maybe, you know, this guy is not who they thought he was. And this is the truth. He is not, even his populist positions on trade, and I absolutely believe this is true. You know, people like to give him credit for that. They gave him credit last night, for that was his strongest part of the debate, was in the beginning when he was kind of nailing her on NAFTA, and, you know, he was it seemed as though he was at least competent on the subject. But I believe people are misinterpreting Donald Trump on trade. Donald Trump doesn't care about workers. He says, I'm going to bring jobs back. But that's a statistic by which he measures American greatness. It is not about those individual workers. He has said over and over again that he thinks that we should bring
wages
competition to the United States, and that basically one state, you can move your plant to another state that wants to lower wages, and those workers will agree to those lower wages.
He said wages are too high. He said wages are too high.
Wages are too high. So this guy's populist, you know, argument is not about the actual workers or even anything, you know, anything specific to individual people's lives. It's about a grand vision of America being number one and beating all those foreigners who he believes have taken advantage. They're not supposed to grow. Only we're supposed to grow. They shouldn't have an economy that there's any growth. The Chinese should be, I don't know, mired in famine or something. That's the only way that we can say that we're on top. It's a nationalist argument. It's not an economic argument. And I think that people have misinterpreted him all the way along. And if you see when he talks about, you know, like the potential trade war with China, which of course he's threatening every 5 minutes, really, when he says that, it's very often in conjunction with his argument about how the Chinese don't respect us and they're building this air base or this island in the middle of the South China Sea and breaking the treaties, and we're going to have to do that. And that is that's a national security thing there. That has nothing to do with trade, but it's often in the same breath that he's saying this. It's about being, you know, disrespected. That's his entire view, is that America isn't treated well in his view. And so I think that people misinterpret that, and I think that kind of digging at him as she did last night from the other side, which is saying, you know, what about the workers? What about the people you didn't pay? What about the fact that you don't pay taxes? I think that makes an argument that starts to kind of make you wonder, what is he talking about with this trade? I hope so.
Well, the irony is,
because I think people are being misled.
The irony is that the big argument we're hearing in favor of TPP now is more of a national security one, it seems to me, because I think the sort of the people promoting the trade pact realize, like, we're not getting anywhere by arguing this is going to help from a trade perspective, because from a trade perspective, by all rights, this really doesn't have that much impact. Like, we already have trade agreements with these countries. The GDP that it's going to add is negligible over the course of like 30, 40 years or something. So the biggest argument we're hearing about passing the TPP at this point is a national security one. Bill Clinton made this argument the other day on CNBC. Mm-hmm. President Obama has made this. You're hearing a lot of people argue that it's a national security, prevent China from dictating the rules going forward. So it's a similar one in some ways to what Trump is arguing. And you're right about the jobs. He looks at jobs as a metric for how well corporate America is doing, as opposed to I'm going to protect workers in the context of these trade deals. That's interesting. But let's also we have a clip of him defending tax cuts for the wealthy. Now, I have to say, Digby, I'm a little surprised that Clinton did not raise her estate tax proposal that was clearly aimed at Donald Trump, if we believe his assets are what they say. Yeah, I mean, this is where you would raise the top rate on the estate tax to 65%. For estates that were over $500 million and presumably over, you know, so I guess for dollars over $500 million. So it wouldn't be a 65% there. It would be 50% up to the first $600 million. I mean, this is what's amazing about this clip, too, as I think there's a lot of it, you hear people arguing about millions of dollars, and it just sounds like, wait, what? But here is Trump defending tax cuts for the wealthy.
Well, I'm really calling for major jobs because the wealthy are going to create tremendous jobs. They're going to expand their companies. They're going to do a tremendous job. I'm getting rid of the carried interest provision. And if you really look, it's not a tax. It's really not a great thing for the wealthy. It's a great thing for middle class. It's a great thing for companies to expand. And when these people are going to put billions and billions of dollars into companies, and when they're going to bring $2.5 trillion back from overseas where they can't bring the money back, because politicians like Secretary Clinton won't allow them to bring the money back because the taxes are so onerous and the bureaucratic red tape. So what is so bad? So what they're doing is they're leaving our country, and they're, believe it or not, leaving because taxes are too high and because some of them have lots of money outside of our country. And instead of bringing it back and putting the money to work because they can't work out a deal to, and everybody agrees it should be brought back, instead of that, they're leaving our country to get their money because they can't bring their money back into our country because of bureaucratic red tape, because they can't get together. Because we have a president that can't sit them around a table and get them to approve something. And here's the thing. Republicans and Democrats agree that this should be done.
We've looked at your...
All right, so there it is. I think basically as he's like just jibber jabbering, he's remembering, oh, they told me to say bureaucratic red tape. Okay. Bureaucratic red tape. I gotta say I was much more impressed when Mitt Romney, was peddling this nonsense because he seemed to actually be able to sort of string phrases together that were related in some fashion. Like,
I mean,
he would use conjunctions
I mean,
instead
like
of just
speaking
commas.
A foreign language to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like that was one of his, and he had a lot of incoherent moments, but that was one of the most obvious. And of course, everything he was saying. I mean, this just shows, you know, that Trump has spent a lot of time watching Fox News and talking
right.
to Sean Hannity, and not understanding that his entire populist argument. He just undermined it with everything that he said. Everything he said there was, we need to have, you know, we need to give the billionaires more money because they'll spend billions. And, you know, I mean, that's the oldest Republican conservative line in the business, right? We've got to cut their taxes so that they'll come back and create, you know, be job creators. You
It'll
know,
trickle
what was it,
down.
The
it's
makers
all trickle-
and takers,
right.
you know. And he, you know, he basically was just sort of regurgitating certain talking points that he's absorbed over the years with no incoherently stringing them together. I mean, there were certain phrases in there that were familiar. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, to me, obviously the people who love him, I don't really think economics has a whole lot to do with it, to be honest. I mean, I think they maybe have economic issues, and they're applying whatever they hear from him as some sort of a solution, but that's not what they love about him. What they love about him is his, you know, I'm going to kick ass and take names, and I'm tired of all this political correctness, and, you know, the rest of that, I think, is the central part of their argument. It's more of an attitude thing. But, you know, his, you know, you were sort of wondering why Clinton didn't hit him harder on that.
On the estate
tax. I think she's probably saving some.
Right. That's a good point.
Personally.
She probably didn't feel like she needed it after, like, she's got to be sitting there as he's, like, doing that mumbo-jumbo go and just going, check, you know, on to the next one.
Well, it is. I mean, weren't we all? I mean, in fact, I think, I mean, one of the things that Trump didn't know, I'll be very interested to hear if he watches the debate, if he watches himself. I've never heard that he does that. I don't know that he does watch himself. If he does, he will see that the split screen is very devastating to him, and it was last night because, you know, what you saw, first of all, there was no height differential when you see it like that. You see the two of them on totally equal footing, which is, you know, I mean, it's an important visual image to see the two that way. And she was, you know, very, if she reacted to him when he was speaking, it was usually with humor. Maybe laughing a little bit, raise her eyebrows or whatever, but it wasn't, in, you know, she
David
was not
Frum
defensive.
Felt she laughed too much.
Oh, please.
She grinned too much.
Please, please.
Yes.
Normally, she doesn't smile enough. There's
right, exactly.
Smile, Hillary. You
she's got
to
get this
no,
right
she did
to
fine.
Be president.
That's what she did.
Here is something that I think is like, is in you know, largely speaking, relatively meaningless. But I think that in some ways, a claim like this from Trump does more damage to him than even his mumbo jumbo about taxes and all the other things, because it is basically like taking somebody and dunking them in a swimming pool and saying, you are dry. Here is Donald Trump arguing that his temperament is better than Hillary's. This is
why is your judgment any different than Mrs. Clinton?
Well, I have much better judgment than she does. There's no question about that. I also have a much better temperament than she has. You know, I have a much better. She spent, let me tell you, she spent hundreds of millions of dollars on an advertising. You know, they get Madison Avenue into a room, they put names. Oh, temperament, let's go after. I think my strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament. I have a winning temperament. I know how to win. She does not have
Secretary
how to win.
Clinton.
Wait. The AFL-CIO the other day, behind the blue screen, I don't know who you were talking to, Secretary Clinton, but you were totally out of control. I said, there's a person with a temperament that's got a problem.
Secretary Clinton.
Woo, okay.
I mean... I mean, at that point, I think I would have just looked at Lester Holt and said, what do you want me to say?
Yeah, what? Okay. I mean,
my
this
favorite
is,
part
this
is
the kind.
My favorite part is, I'm sorry, he says he's arguing he has a better temperament and basically tells Lester Holt to shut up. Let me finish and explain why I have a better temperament.
I know. And this is after, I mean, the guy has spent the entire time up to that point basically pouting, you know, sniffing, you know, rolling his eyes, shrugging his shoulders. I mean, he was behaving with the, you know, just on the pure visual of it, like a 14-year-old boy. And that may be unfair to 14-year-old boys, but I mean, it was obvious that he has a very, I'll put it kindly, an immature temperament. He is not in control of himself and does not know how to do this. And that's very obvious. It's been obvious the whole way along.
Right.
Now, some people like that about him. And they feel, you know, I don't know, they relate to it in some way. I mean, they like George W. Bush, too. And he was also kind of juvenile and
but they
know,
like that.
In his behavior.
But they recognize it. Like, that's my, I think this impeaches him as a witness, essentially, more than anything else. Because I think the people who do appreciate his temperament will basically say, yeah, he doesn't have a very good temperament, and I like that about him.
Right.
They would never say he's got a better temperament. Like, they would never say that he is. I just think that's something that people like about him. And when he's sort of denying a central facet about him. Like, if he said, you know what? I know why people say that, because I shoot from the hip and I say what's on my mind, and we're not used to that. But I think we need some of that in the presidency. Then I think he successfully does that. But he denies something that is so obvious. I mean, I think it really undercuts faith, even in his most faithful. I mean, look, there's 35% of the country, I think, where he's right. He could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and they'd just be like, where should we put the body, Mr. Trump? But I think beyond that, I think impeaches his sort of, I don't know.
I think you're right. I hadn't thought about that before, but I think you're absolutely right about that. When he just asserts something boldly like that, that isn't true, I think that there are some people who are kind of going, hey, wait a minute, you know, yeah, you don't have, you know, you're hot tempered, you know, you're somebody who, you know, you tell it like it is. That's what we like about you. Him not being able to admit that is kind of, I mean, I think that there have to be some people out there who are going, well, wait a minute, you know, I like the fact that you are a loose cannon. That's what we need in there, like George Patton or whatever. You know, I mean, he sounds like he's contradicting himself. And I think, and certainly contradicting their impression of him, which is clearly, I mean, you cannot, the idea that he, you know, and I've sort of done this through the whole campaign. I've been noting this as the, you know, I know you are, but what am I strategy? You know, people say, well, you know, she has the better temperament. All the polling says that. It's obvious. She is a calm and rational, you know, highly skilled mainstream politician. That is who she is, you know, for better or worse. The one thing you can't say about Hillary Clinton is that she doesn't have, a steely kind of, you know, she doesn't quit. She's a very,
the right wing meme is that she's a robot. Right? I mean, so how do you say that she's out of control, but she's also a robot? She's one of those out of control robots.
Out of control robots.
One of those weird women robots. You know, I mean, oh my God. And, you know, I think, I mean, he, you know, it is just patently obvious that he is something other than that. And that even though, so he looks at the polls and says, well, that's just wrong. I'm better than her. My temperament is better than her. Instead of saying to himself, well, they're misinterpreting that, or my temperament is different, you know, people like this about me, blah, blah, blah. He automatically rejects any criticism. Criticism is just, it's just wrong. And whatever they're saying is absolutely the opposite of reality. So if they say she has a better temperament, he says, that's absolutely wrong. I have a better temperament. They say she has more experience. Wrong. I have more experience, even though it's patently bizarre and wrong. Although, you know, he I don't know how he does on this honesty and trustworthy thing. They are both sort of in the dirt on that one. And it's interesting that didn't come up last night. I assume it will as time goes on.
And yes. And I'm glad that it didn't. I mean, I think to Lester Holt's credit, like, you know, we get it. Nobody thinks that they're trustworthy, and
they're all a bunch of liars.
Well,
okay?
That's what I mean. I think why I thought Lester Holt put it on such good playing field, because I just honestly, I put in the like, what's your favorite color? Quick, don't think twice. You know, like we don't really care.
If you were a tree, what kind would you be? You know, all that kind of stuff. We don't need that. Although I think it's the next one's a town hall, isn't it? So we may find a little bit more of that sort of thing if the questions come from the people. Although, in reality, when they do throw the questions to actual, you know, regular humans, they do tend to be more substantive.
I think
so. It's the media that does this you know, performance art thing that they do.
Although I got to say, the Lester Holt did a great job with that. All right, let's talk about this one last thing, or maybe we'll talk about these two last things, because Clinton clearly wanted to bring this into the debate, and so much so that she sort of, you know, almost shoved it in at the end of the debate. And good for her, because it ended up being, I think, you know, Trump's con moment, if you will. This is where Clinton talks about how Donald Trump treats women, and specifically raises the story of a woman who was, I guess, a Miss Universe pageant winner, right the year that Donald Trump bought it. Here, this is clip number six.
He tried to switch from looks to stamina. But this is a man who has called women pigs, slobs, and dogs. And someone who has said pregnancy is an inconvenience to employers, who has said women don't deserve equal pay unless they do as good a job as men. And one of the worst things he said was about a woman in a beauty contest. He loves beauty contests, supporting them and hanging around them. And he called this woman Miss Piggy. Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina. Donald, she has a name.
Where did you find
her?
This?
Name
Where
is
did
Alicia
you find this?
Machado.
Where did you find her?
And
it?
She has become a U.S. citizen, and you can bet she's going to vote this November.
Okay, good. Let me just tell you.
Mr. Trump, if you take 10 seconds, and then we're going to have a final question.
Hillary is hitting me with tremendous commercials. Some of it said in entertainment. Some of it said somebody who's been very vicious to me, Rosie O'Donnell. I said very tough things to her, and I think everybody would agree that she deserves it, and nobody feels sorry for her.
Now, there he is. First of all, she baits him, and then he forgets he's not in a Republican primary anymore. And people don't want that out of their president. I mean, that was, he forgot where he was. He was so rattled, I think, by Clinton's ability to actually name that woman. And so clear that this was not a story, because I think he gets his information so secondhand that he always thinks there's some fallibility to the information. But she made it very clear. We know who she is. We've found her. We've talked to her. And in fact, there is an ad out that is devastating from her. Devastating in Spanish that I think is going to be very problematic for him. But that moment, I thought, was really another one where he slipped mightily.
Oh, absolutely. He was clearly rattled by that. I mean, he was, where did you hear that? Where'd you get that? Where'd you get that? Where'd you, you know, like, what? Why would you say that in the middle of this debate in front of 100 million people? You know, he was absolutely upset by it. And I thought she chose her moment pretty well. It wasn't easy, but Lester Holt did bring up the idea that he had said she didn't look presidential and didn't have the strength and the stamina to be president, which is essentially both a sexist and an ageist argument, which, you know, coming from the man who's older than her is a little bit much, but nonetheless, that's what it is. And so she saw that she had her moment to bring that up. And it is very powerful. I mean, from the perspective of a woman, I have to say that these crude remarks that he makes about women commonly, including, by the way, Rosie O'Donnell, who is a human being, and not everyone agrees that it's okay to say those things about her. And the idea that he would bring her up, you know, middle America knows Rosie O'Donnell, too. It's not like, you know, he's the big reality TV star. She's a star, too.
Yep.
And people know who she is. And there are plenty of women out there who are just kind of, oh, you know, believe me, this is a very familiar kind of thing to a lot of us. To hear this kind of stuff, it just, it brings him to a level of just, he's a brute. And, I think maybe there are people out there who think that's a cool thing, but I think there are many women who were just, you know, find him to be grotesque in this way. And that ad, by the way, anybody who's listening here, if you haven't seen it, you need to go see it. She released, I think it's probably on Hillary Clinton.
We're going to play it later. We're going to play it later in the thing. But
it's amazing. And the campaign. See, I mean, this is the difference between a professional campaign and this fly by night thrown together thing that Trump has. She prepared for the debate. She's actually, you know, takes the job seriously enough to do studying and to try and plan how to win this debate. I mean, that is something she believes is important, to actually do some planning. Clearly, Donald Trump doesn't believe that and doesn't think he needs to do that. His instincts will always carry him. That should be a red flag.
I think he prepared more for this debate than he did for any of the ones in the past.
Oh,
I think in Donald Trump's world, he did prepare.
He studied.
He worked hard, honestly. He had people there, you know, relative to what he's usually does to prepare for things. And what was fascinating to me was that I knew that Clinton had won the debate when it was, what's her, Kylie, one of both Kylie.
Kayleigh McEnany.
And Kellyanne Conway. I heard this both from them within like 15 minutes on different TV shows that Clinton, they were mocking Clinton for preparing so much. And it was just sort of like, if that's what you're going to, you know, if you're saying like, but she prepared, of course she won, you know, like then I think you've got a big problem. So, so Trump gets so rattled by this. He goes on Fox and Friends today. And to a large extent, like, you know why Trump gets thrown off by this stuff. The same reason why anybody listening to this program could call into a right-wing talk show and debate with a right-wing talker and win, because you're just not used to having anybody actually question them. Here is Donald Trump on the phone doubling down on his calling of this, I think, former Miss Universe a winner, or this Miss Universe winner, a Miss Piggy and Miss Housekeeping. He did this on Fox and Friends this morning. Listen to this.
Let's find out what he's going to release.
She was trying to get under your skin a couple of times, did she?
No, not at all. I didn't see it that way. At the end, maybe, the very last question, when she brought up the person that became, you know, I know that person, was a Miss Universe person, and she was the worst we ever had. The worst, the absolute worst. She was impossible. And she was a Miss Universe contestant and ultimately a winner who they had a tremendously difficult time with as Miss Universe.
Did not know that story.
Well, I didn't know either.
She was the winner, and, you know, she gained a massive amount of weight. And it was a real problem. We had a real problem. Not only that, her attitude, and we had a real problem with her. So Hillary went back into the years, and she found this girl. This was many years ago, and found the girl and talked about her like she was Mother Teresa. And it wasn't quite that way, but that's okay. You know, Hillary has to do what she has to do. You know,
talked about her like she was Mother Teresa, who was very skinny. Mother Teresa was very thin. And yes. This one, not so.
Not so thin. Well, I mean, first of all, that's just reprehensible. Yeah. I mean, it makes me sick to listen to him talk about that. I hope that clip gets out there, because him, you know, doubling down, not only saying that she was fat, which, you know, plenty of American women and American men, like Donald Trump, for instance, struggle with their weight. And the idea of a president actually saying that kind of thing about women, and then going on to talk about her like, you know, well, she was difficult, she was a problem.
Miss Housekeeping, because she's Latino.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's just absolutely horrifying. And when you see the ad, which the Clinton campaign very, you know, deftly, they released it instantly after the debate, she is a very, you know, obviously she's a beautiful woman. She was a Miss Universe, and it tells the whole story of what happened.
Donald Trump was
a repulsive human being. He complained to the press. He said, this one likes to eat. And he brought the press in to observe her working out and show them. And also, by the way,
ambushed her,
you know, yeah, ambushed her. And, by the way, reinforcing what we were talking about earlier, she goes on to say, I made him a lot of money by all those appearances and doing all this stuff, and she never saw a penny of it. I mean, they basically, apparently, on Donald Trump's Miss Universe, you pretty much are, you know, slave labor during the year that you're
part of. Yeah, you get 10% for the commercials you're in. You get 10%.
Yeah, I mean,
what? Are you kidding me? And
yeah,
they
I mean,
didn't, didn't
know,
even
it
pay
was,
her
it,
that.
It, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, again, with the exploitation and the way that he is, you know, is with women, and him now going on Fox and Friends and saying that, you know, she was a problem, and she was, you know, basically he was saying, you know, she wasn't a good little girl. That's how women will hear that. And certainly I would imagine many Latinas would hear what he's saying about her as well, that, you know, need to be seen and not heard kind of thing.
Miss Housekeeping was a little uppity, apparently, trying to stand up for her rights as a human being, and he didn't like that. It was an absolutely devastating moment. I felt like it was an incredible put-away shot. He was very, rattled by it, and clearly kind of, where did this come
from?
He seems
wounded. I mean, he was, like, his reaction of, like, where'd you get that? Like, that is, I mean, people should contemplate this. There was something really dark about that. Like, how did you find her? Like, yeah. I think he felt like, wait, she speaks Spanish in this. I don't know if she speaks English. I don't know. I presume she does to a certain extent. But I think he just felt like, I tried to crush her. Like, she was put in a box. How'd you find her? He seemed very angry about it and just sort of like betrayed. But I don't feel like, I don't know. I feel like it's like he just thinks that sometimes some of the victims that he has squashed, he has cleaned up in such a way or buried in such a way that I think he was really shocked by that. And I got to say, at the end of that video, it's about a 2.5-minute video with Alicia Machado. She seems extremely happy to be voting against this guy and telling her story. I mean, very happy in a way like this is. And I imagine the dynamic is such that she never thought that she would have the opportunity to inflict even the slightest bit of pain of the pain that he clearly inflicted upon her. And I think she feels, you know, empowered. And to a certain extent, she is. I mean, because she's going to have an opportunity to make him pay at least somewhat for the way that she was treated by him.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that there are plenty of women who identify with her on that, who, you know, have endured that sort of thing at the hands of people like Donald Trump and Roger Ailes and other powerful men in their lives, and to see somebody be able to stand up years later and go, no, you know, we don't have to put up with this, and to be actually be in her position to fight back. And I think that, you know, in some ways, you know, for women, I mean, I realize that this is sort of a theme that you know, people are kind of, whatever. But I think there is a sense among women, particularly, it's you know, it's about Hillary Clinton, of course, and her accomplishments and how far she's come and what she's endured to get to the point where she is, where she can actually be the nominee of a major party. But it's also, you know, the fact that who did they put up against her? Who did the other side of this argument, as far as women are concerned,
right,
feminist women in the world, who did they put up to fight her? They put up this crude, brutish, misogynist asshole. I mean, I'm sorry, there's just no other way to put it with him. And that says everything. It says exactly where, you know, what that fight is all about. They crystallized it, not her. You know, Clinton, you know, worked for 30, 40 years to get to this point. She's done all the things you're supposed to do. She worked hard. She got up to this point, and so now she's the first major party nominee. All of that is something that you could have seen as a natural progression for women's rights in this country. But look what they put up against her. Look,
right?
Who
it would
they,
have been like running Steve Scalise against Barack Obama.
Yeah, you know, like, I mean, exactly. It's like, you know, you want to put up, you know, Barack Obama. We're going to put up David Duke. I mean,
right.
that's the way that they responded here. And I think a lot of that had to do with Barack Obama. Which my view is that, you know, I remember what's his name, Wayne LaPierre from the NRA, saying at some point, you know, we've had just we've had 8 years of their social experiment. We don't need any more. I mean, the idea of putting up another first, I think, was seen as tremendously offensive to many Republican voters who were just going, wait a minute, we had a black man. We had to put up with that. Now you want us to deal with a woman? Are you kidding? You know, no, we're not going to do that. And along comes Donald Trump, and he's the perfect personification of that, you know, misogynist id that's out there, you know, sort of, you know, roiling through our, you know, our sort of collective, you know, psychology. And he sort of stands for that. So her being able to put that out there and use that actual, you know, that real woman, a Latina to boot, who also stands in for, you know, many millions right. of, you know, immigrants and others who have been absolutely, you know, treated as if they are, you know, subhuman by Donald Trump and his followers, the way that they speak of them, the disgusting attempts to sort of put them into this category of others in our society, Muslims. Disabled people. I mean, I read something about a disabled fellow at a, you know, she's been doing a lot of disability rights stuff. It doesn't get much press, but she's been doing that lately and really, really trying to, you know, rally the disabled community to her side. And a lot of the disabled people who have, you know, started to sort of volunteer and work for her, they say that this is extremely meaningful to them because how dare the Republicans put up someone like him, someone who is so obviously crude and childish and you know, it's like the worst playground bully in the world making fun of disabled people. And this man is running for president. I mean, that's something you'd think no one would do over the age of five, right? I mean, you must have taught your kids that that's absolutely unacceptable, you know, if they tried that. And here we have a president who's doing it. So, you know, this kind of identification, I think, on the part of plenty of people, it's, you know, it's about her, and I think she's done a good job with that. But it's also about him. It's about, you know, look at what they, look at what they're trying to do. Look at who they've chosen to represent them, and it's a horrifying prospect. It really is. I mean, I don't think it's not just that he's unfit for the presidency, which of course he is. It's also that he is a representative of a dark and ugly strain in American politics. And God help us, I hope that we end up rejecting that, because if we don't, we're really in bigger trouble than I think we thought.
I agree. And it is fascinating to see that really the only thing that is keeping Trump in this race is the polls. It's tough to get a good sense of this, and that there is an inordinate amount. There is an inordinate, or I should say, even relative to Obama's wins in 2012 and 2008, there is a significantly larger deficit when it comes to white people, and particularly white males. And, yeah. You know, there is that quality of where sort of race and gender, I think, on some level, become sort of melded into that attitude. And I think your point is well taken. There is a sense of like, hey, wait a second. It's one thing to give up one place in line. You know, we can take a break for one, but you're going to do this twice in a row now? And then what happens after that? We're going to have some type of Latino or, you know, who knows what. You know, I think there is a real quality, like, we better put the brakes on this. This is, you know, this is
really getting out of hand now.
We're on the slippery slope. We're going to miss two turns in a row. Digby, thanks so much for your time today. Went a little long.
Oh, my pleasure.
Appreciate
Sam.
It. Thanks, Digby. All right, sure. Folks. We're gonna take a break. When we go into the fun half, we're going to. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you're just telling me, Christy laughed, apparently, according to David Wildstein, as the. Do you think he laughed like he's going to jail, or he probably didn't put that he's going to jail part at the end? Did he?
I don't think so.
No. I wonder if he went like. I'm going to come up with a bunch of different versions of the laugh. As I read more of that testimony, I'm so glad. I'm having an enjoyable day today. When we come back, we will play more audio from the debate. We also, we got Michael Schur of TYT. Very smart, knowledgeable commentator at TYT. Interviewed Scotty B.
From Dude.
Yeah, who was in the spin room, and Scotty B. was, you know, he was there to back up his butt, the D-man, the Donald, but Nevertheless, you know, Scotty B, he must always speaketh the truth. And so he did say there were some things that he would have done a little differently. You know, the bottom line is, you put Scotty B in there. He reminded everybody he won 19 elections, only lost two. He beat one girl. That was Martha Coakley.
Oh, my God. I beat her like a drum, dude.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was almost like the comma of, like, weird middle-aged chicks, because then I lost, like, two of them back-to-back.
That's right.
It was the most traumatic experience. Wait, is that Andrea Tentaros?
All right, we're going to get to that sound and more on the fun half. Also, Glenn Beck. Yeesh, this guy, he's having a tough time of it.
We always say that, and it's always true.
Yeah. Well, I think with a guy like Beck, I mean, he's not going to, I don't think he's going to be around for forever. Let's put it that way. I don't want to say, like, I just think that, like, he has so many emotional breakdowns. And this one he does his radio show now, not in front of a microphone, but with a lavalier mic on, walking through, pacing through, almost through a fake Oval Office set.
It's the best.
As if he's, like, dealing with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
The Cuban Missile Crisis of his own mind.
I mean, it's so fantastic. Oh, geez. Man, I mean, what's going to make today better for me? I don't think anything. But if somebody, like, I don't know, if I find a chocolate bar in the fridge from, like, 6 weeks ago that I can eat because, I don't know. I don't know why 6 weeks. But, like, I had forgotten
government bonds that I discovered that I didn't know I had.
Oh, my God. Are you aware of this website, which will give you push alerts every time the Social Security Administration does a different actuarial table? All right. We're going to take a break. Folks, a reminder. Yeah, we went long. Yeah, we did. All right. Maybe we won't do a show on Thursday. I mean, I'm fried, but what's that? It's only Tuesday?
I just can't believe it's Tuesday. At the end of last night, I realized that it was only Monday as I was leaving. And it's just so much energy went into my body. Like, my body was just using so much energy before the debate.
There was a lot of technical
with
issues.
Anxiety. Okay, yes, there was that. I wasn't kidding. There was that, but just anxiety about things looking good. Looking good for Trump. I was so worried that I guess it felt like Friday.
I told you before the debate, don't worry about it.
Just do
Trump's not going to. Oh, okay. Yeah.
I mean, there's no way in my mind for him to actually have won in any scenario, but he could have come out looking far better.
Yeah, I have to say, it did occur to me, though, that while you're talking about it, I was just like, you know what, Hillary, you can say that I'm totally uninformed and it's dangerous that I even have that position. I have no idea what I'm talking about. But when you drag up a really traumatic experience, like a former Miss World getting fat on me, that has really gone below any standards of decency that I would expect in a general election. She put on pounds. And you know what? I was going to try to handle this with some decorum, but now the gloves are off. She ruined my life.
Yeah, I mean, it was very nerve-wracking because, as much as I want her to win, it's not like I trust her not to act condescendingly or, you know.
She did very well. I mean, I think I said that at the end of the thing last night. Like, if you came into this without any knowledge really of either one of them or just with what you had heard, you'd walk away thinking, like, she seems pleasant enough. He seems like an a-hole.
In the first 5 minutes or so, I said to Matt that it seemed like she had just, they'd been like, okay, lose half your vocabulary. You don't need it.
Right.
That's not what you want to do here.
I thought she came off as sort of, she was much more, it seemed to me.
Normal than usual?
Yeah, relaxed, just not on the defensive. And was actually, I think, to a certain extent, having a little fun doing this. Like, let's see if I can drive him crazy with this.
Yeah, I mean, it happened
when
so early.
When she gained that weight, she was, when I say she was sitting around the Miss Universe's offices, I mean, she was sitting around the...
You know what? That's a great joke, but it didn't even crack me up because it was actually so genuinely upsetting
folks,
that I could barely contain myself.
You can support this program by becoming a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Click on the Jet.com link. Bookmark those links. Always buy your Jet or Amazon stuff there. We get a kickback. See you in the fun half.